Welcome to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast with your host, Steve Abramowitz, editor-in-chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper.
Welcome back to the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast. We are focusing on the volunteer state with always an interesting person making a positive change in our community. This time, special guest Tina Tobit. But first, for more information about the Mill Creek View podcast, visit us anywhere you get your podcasts and socials at Mill Creek View, Tennessee. While you're there, please subscribe. Welcome to the People in the News episode, where I interview people who are making an impact and are lovers of truth. Today, we are talking with Tina Tobit. Tennessee Liberty Network is dedicated to reclaiming liberty for Tennesseans through research, education, action, and community building. One people, one fight for liberty. It is focused on reviving and restoring the knowledge of and passion for the liberty Tennessee was founded upon, based on the ideas found within the Declaration of Constitutional Consent, which reestablishes the relationship between the free citizens of the states and the central government, denouncing the usurpations of their consent by the latter. Liberty Network's mission is to ensure the citizens of Tennessee are able to pursue happiness by embracing true liberty, free from central government control beyond their consent. To fulfill this mission, TLN will focus on educating the public and elected representatives about the original intent for America, the role of the Constitution of the United States, and the philosophy of natural rights to enable states to utilize their sovereignty guaranteed in the Constitution and the 9th and 10th Amendments. They are committed to finding persons capable and willing to represent those values and promote their elections, to hold representatives accountable for exceeding their authority or failing to represent their constituents, and to ensure free and fair elections through legislative acts and transparencies. Tina Tobin is one of Tennessee Liberty Network's election integrity and voter fraud researchers in collaboration with other election integrity groups across the state. Tobin gives presentations on voting machines' vulnerabilities based on her exhaustive research. In Tennessee, that person is Tina Tobin. Tina, how are you today, ma'am?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Thanks so much for coming on the Mill Creek View, Tennessee podcast to tell us about the success of Tennessee Liberty here and around the country. Can you give us a little information about your background and what activated you to get involved with Tennessee Liberty, please?
Okay. I think we really started to get involved when we were having all these COVID regulations and all these lockdowns, and it was very hard for people to connect with each other. We heard about like the Reopen Tennessee rally, and I brought my son, but for the most part, we didn't know local people that were willing. We knew people that were Republicans, but maybe not conservatives that were willing to spend their day down at the Capitol. And so that's really when we got the chance to connect with Tennessee Liberty Network. And then they had a Telegram channel, which was like, wow, we can all connect and we're not shadow banned, we're not blocked, we can actually plan things. And so it was a great way to collaborate. And that was really what got it rolling. And pretty quickly, we all kind of fell into our little niche categories. So I had always, helped local candidates to, campaign and work the polls on election day. So, it just kind of fell into, it was easy for me to do some of that research versus, the people who specialized in medical that I know nothing about.
And back in 2018, besides COVID and having to navigate, masks in the grocery store or not, what were some of the big issues that you had to tackle right out of the gate?
We were very concerned when we had all these politicians that just didn't seem concerned about businesses having to close. And So it didn't take that long before we stopped concentrating on the policies and started concentrating on the politicians. Like, where is all this coming from? And we pretty quickly discovered that we have quite a few pharmacists that are in our state legislature. Our state Senate has at least three that I can think of off the top of my head. There may even be a fourth. But we only have 33 state senator. So that seems like, well, that's a pretty big number. And in real life, I don't really know that many pharmacists. So to have such a large concentration, just in our state senate, not to mention throughout the legislature, and all the connections that we saw, big hospitals, just big healthcare in general. So, once we started to see all that, the next logical thing was, we really need to look at these elections and see what's going on. And, one thing led to another. And of course, with everything that happened with the 2020 election, we started digging even deeper to understand how some of these people were being elected in Tennessee that just didn't seem to represent the values of their communities.
Right, and this is supposed to be the reddest of red states. So you're in Sumner County. And for those that don't know, there are 99 counties, so that's one of 99. How long have you been in Tennessee? And I'm sure you're a busy person, but chose to add this to your busy schedule. How do you juggle Tennessee Liberty and the rest of your life?
I mean, it's just so important. And I guess, I've always spent a fair amount of my free time involved in political endeavors. So at least that kind of helped that I could just kind of switch to, maybe some things that I would normally do, helping the local, political parties I would do, instead, specifically looking at election integrity. And right now we've been in Tennessee about 4 years. But we about 10 years ago, we lived here also for 4 years. My husband's job, used to move us around a lot. So we were very excited to get back to Tennessee. But boy, in the time that we were gone, I mean, it changed drastically, in growth and in attitude. It's kind of shocking.
Yeah, and Tennessee used to be, people forget, a Democratic state, but that changed in the 2000s, I believe. And now it's pretty solid red. Of the 99 counties, 75 reps are Republican, and 24, I believe, are Democrat and one independent. So they really could leave for Colorado, and Republicans will still have quorum and can do what Republicans are supposed to do. But you found, like I've found, they don't always do that. Now, your website, Restore Liberty, I believe, has a sanctuary status map that has 100% in Tennessee, right? And you're asking governors and legislatures to create constitutional sanctuary states, which is kind of crazy to think that's needed since we're a republic, each state with a constitution already. And even though most people think we're a democracy, but we're not, because that would be mob rule. We are representative government. You're talking about the representatives that you have to deal with now, except in Oregon and cities of Seattle and San Francisco, which are kind of lost. But that's not Tennessee. Is Tennessee willing to abide by your constitutional sanctuary category?
Well, I think we found in almost every situation that when you look at the kind of laws that are presented in Tennessee, they look great. They have wonderful titles, and when you dig into them, they just don't do what you would think that they do. We saw that with constitutional carry, where when Tennessee firearms got involved and went through the bill, they felt that did the opposite in a lot of ways, kind of created a false sense of security for people. We see that same thing with education. And everyone says, oh, CRT is illegal in Tennessee. Well, technically it is, but it gets defined by, the woman who was appointed by Bill Lee to be in charge of education, Penny Schwinn, and she gets to define what CRT is. And given that she's from Berkeley, her definition of CRT is nothing like, what a traditional Tennessee value of CRT, how we would define it.
So a little
So,
bit of false advertising then in the bill titles, where you have to dig into the fine print to say, wait a minute, this isn't Republican or Tennessee values. This is more liberal agenda items under a false wrapper, so to speak. But what is Tennessee doing that earned 100%? I assume there are states that are down in the 50s or 40s or zeros. What do we do right?
Well, I mean, when I like one thing in elections, everyone has been saying, how Tennessee were, according to Heritage Foundation, we were voted number one for election integrity. And, that's a great example of, You know, we do have some good laws on the books. There are lots of loopholes, but election-wise, if you look, we have voter ID, so that's a big plus. I mean, there are states where you could go in with a piece of mail marked resident, and you could same day register and vote. So, I mean, it's kind of shocking. So, in that sense, we do well with that. We don't have mail-in ballots, so we have quite a few good laws, and I do appreciate that, our legislature has done that. But the big vulnerability that we have is, we do have some really dirty voter rolls that very much need to be cleaned up. We're hoping that for 2023, a non-election year, that we will see that. But the big giant thing is the voting machines. I mean, as long as we have these voting machines, you can cheat on such a mass scale. So,
Yeah,
some
I
of
want to get
these,
into that
oh,
in
yeah.
more detail for sure. Just a little more background. Heritage.org did give us the number one of the 50 states, but that was only an 85, which is about a B-ish in my daughter's high school. So even though it's the best of the rest of them, it's still pretty bad on even their own scale. So we're kind of hanging our hat on the number one, but we could do better, of course. Now, you wrote a letter on the vulnerabilities of microvote Infinity direct recording electronic machines. Let me quote that. You said, even a single vulnerability in a voting machine puts the entire process of having free and fair elections at risk. And microvote has been found to have multiple vulnerabilities that have plagued their machines for 2 decades. Microvote was removed from 9 states: Arkansas, Iowa, Kansas, Kentucky, Michigan, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina. That's my words, not yours. I thought we used ESS machines. Who is Microvote, and were they used in November's elections, and why? Why don't we just get rid of them?
Oh, absolutely. We have across Tennessee, we have five different vendors. So we use all the big ones. We use Dominion, ES&S, and Hart. And then we also have Microvote, which, even though it's a small company only used here and in Indiana, it's the most popular voting machine in the state. It's used in 45 counties. And then we have another little teeny one called Unison. So those we have five vendors, and then by the time you add up the different models, the different versions across the state, we have about 35 different voting machines that are in use in Tennessee.
Wow.
So
And all you,
yes.
all, I
So.
mean, you think you could do it with a Las Vegas dollar counting machine? It's just one vote, one person, one tally, one certification. Why do we need all these complexities with 35 machines that apparently don't do what they're supposed to do, which is count?
And it gives such complexity. And then, one thing that people don't realize is that, Tennessee, yes, we have, some good laws, but by having these voting machines, the federal government has declared that they are, critical infrastructure, these machines. So they fall under the Department of Homeland Security and the division called CISA, and they handle all of the cybersecurity. So there are all these proprietary things that, we don't know anything about. I mean, essentially the same people from, Homeland Security that tell you you're safe on a plane because, someone from TSA has thrown away your toothpaste, are the same people telling you that these machines are secure. You can't look at them. No one has ever seen inside these machines in the state of Tennessee. They're proprietary, so you can't look at the hardware. You can't look at the software. We don't know, are there little cell phone chips in it? Are there any kind of communication devices? We have no idea.
Yeah.
And yet,
And Tennessee certifies voting machines based on a questionnaire sent to Indiana, right? And if Indiana stops using microvote, then Tennessee will not have a method to even certify these machines. Why would we outsource that? We don't need the money. It's cheaper to hand count, from I'm told, than the machines
It is.
anyway. Are you hearing anybody receptive to say, you know what, you're right, we don't need 35 machines, we don't even need one?
We don't really hear it from anyone in the election infrastructure as far as and from top to bottom, from the Secretary of State down to all the county election officials, everyone is appointed. So I think, that's a big problem right there. It's hard. The people are so in favor when we speak to them of getting rid of these machines, especially when they really understand the problems. And they're actually, like, for Microvote, it's, even though it's a machine and it has all of those problems, it's actually quite a manual process. The machine operator, when somebody comes in and, you know, your whichever school board district, and, you know, maybe there's multiple, you know, districts that vote at a precinct, or certainly during early voting, and that machine operator has to actually manually choose each one of those selections so that you get the correct ballot. So it's very strange that it's such a manual process, and we get a lot of complaints. That's one of our biggest complaints, is that people have the wrong ballot pull up on their screen, and it creates chaos.
Yeah, and I would think that one of the very first things that a state like Tennessee, that believes in Make Tennessee Great Again, would want that vote count here in the state, not back in another state like Indiana. And so no election officials or candidates agreed with you to bring that home?
I mean, we have a few legislators that have been supportive, but I mean, they're nowhere near the majority. I don't know if it's mostly, I think, you know, people don't like to rock the boat. This is the same system that got them elected, and there's a lot of money behind it. I mean, the same big lobbying firms that lobby for everything else lobby for the voting machines. So,
and would it take a majority vote of the representatives, or would it take Bill Lee to do a mandate, or would it take a election official commissioner to say, okay, for 2023, I think we have some school board elections, for 2024, when the big one is, the president or the president, would we have it fixed by then? Or are they saying, no, this, we like the status quo. We've only, even though for 200 years, we did it a different way.
Right. I think, I mean, people do definitely like the status quo. And, you know, we just, I think the people that are involved in our elections are so, they're very tied to the vendors. I mean, they're very, you know, they're close with them. I mean, it's, you know, we rely on them for a lot of things. And I think over time, I think it would be a big change for these counties to all of a sudden go back and, you know, take full control of their elections, even though on paper they have control of the elections. Like in Sumner County, for our August election, I was in the counting room, and the Microvote vendors that drove down from Indiana were the ones who did the scanning and tabulating of our absentee ballots. And, you know, I thought that was pretty surprising, because, you know, we have a whole election office that is fully staffed. It seemed like that would definitely be something that we would do. But we find the same thing when we put in open records requests or ask for various reports. Almost always the answer is we need to contact the vendor. So I think everyone has gotten very comfortable with, you know, the vendor running so many important aspects of our elections. But, you know, for that same reason that we get pushback, that's the same reason why, you know, as voters, we need to bring this all back and get rid of these machines.
And is their customer service support good? Would we, if it was a clothing store or a grocery store, would we want to be repeat customers? Do they do a good job of that support, or are they kind of absentee out in New Jersey or New York or wherever they're from and never follow up?
I mean, it does seem like they actually are pretty responsive. So in that sense, you know, but we do also need to bring them in quite a bit, which seems like if you, you know, had other equipment, like equipment in your home, you'd rather just have something that worked, where you know, it's great if you can call tech support and have somebody be responsive, but you'd prefer to just not need the tech support.
Yeah. We've seen reports from Arizona, and obviously in the 2000 election, we saw all kinds of things happening at counting centers in Detroit and wherever else. And of course, 2000, we had the hanging chads in Florida. So it's been a long time that we've had these election irregularities. Does Tennessee have any of those specific type of problems where they changed the printer, or that ran out of ink, or 40% of the printers didn't have paper? Are we seeing egregious things like that here, or is it still a B or better, you know, as we said in the beginning?
We had that in Knox County. They had machines in this past November election where they were They ran out of ballots, and then they had people voting at other locations. They brought in printers that were going to print ballots on the spot, and then they ran out of ink in the printers. So they de there were some crazy things going on.
And do we
And
think that it changed the election in one way that maybe the people didn't agree with, that canvassing would have proved that would have went a different way?
I mean, we don't have enough, we haven't gotten enough details to really know, what was affected. But I mean, we do know for sure that, like in our county, the microvote, they're fully paperless machines. So, for us, we had complaints of people getting the wrong ballots, having names missing, or just having an election missing altogether. Like when we had our city council, there's an at-large, but then you would also have, voting for your exact ward. Half the wards were up at a time, but we had lots of people that said, I only had the at-large, my ward wasn't on there. And so we do have a lot of problems. And we just had a Sumner County commissioner election where it was an exact tie, and the county commission got to decide who, would fill that position. So, these local races, I mean, we've had several complaints for some of them. So that's enough to swing a lot of these local races.
I think so. Now, you, your group, I should say, I don't know if it, you personally, but you endorse Larry Linton for Tennessee House District 12. I think that's the only one in Tennessee that I saw. He lost, but to a Republican, of course, Dale Carr, 82 to 18%. Is Dale your second choice as a Republican? And how are you doing finding more candidates for the future, like Larry, who will be on this podcast next month, by the way? So stay tuned
Oh,
for that.
great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely, I mean, I would say at the local level, like, we have our state group, but then we also, are active in our own county groups. So in Sumner County, we have a group called the Sumner County Constitutional Republicans. And, most of the Liberty Network people that are in Sumner County, belong to that group. So we did get 14 people on our commission, 14 patriots out of 24. So we were able to get the majority there. We got three on school board, and we only got one on Gallatin City Council. But so we have made some progress. But to get to that next level, state rep and state senators, that's it still takes a lot of money. And what we're finding is that with the way the Tennessee rules are, as far as being able to, run as a Republican, we're finding that a lot of conservatives, if they're, relatively new to the state, that they need to run as independents. They won't be allowed to run as Republicans.
And they just passed a law that you have to be here for a select amount of time. That happened in the Ortega, Starbuck, and Andy Ogle's race, where they said you had to be here. Was it 2 years, 5 years?
Yeah, I think that was 2 years.
Two
But
years.
even aside from that, they have that bona fide Republican where, for the most part, they do kind of stick to that if you would have to vote in three state primaries. So really, you would need to be here, 6 years to be able to meet that criteria.
And have voted, right? Exactly.
And have voted. And we run into that a lot too, where, we know some people that say, well, so often the races, everybody's unopposed. So, they're not, maybe I missed a primary because there were no choices and I didn't
Right.
get there. And
Or it's
I
a
mean, I
strange,
always.
litmus test, because what if you say, well, 6 years ago, I didn't like the choices, so I didn't vote for anybody, or I decided to cross the aisle. I was allowed to do it. But tell me, what is your declaration of constitutional consent? What is that? And does Tennessee adhere to it, or have they strayed from it?
I mean, the Declaration of Constitutional Consent is really more, that's actually not something that in elections that I'm as involved in, I mean, we do look for candidates, like in various offices that, are willing to uphold the Constitution. And we kind of have different, in what I do, I have more specific questions for each office, kind of picking apart what would be most appropriate to, their constitutional duties based on that position. So, like for example, for sheriff, We specifically go through a lot of the questions that the Constitutional Sheriffs Association, you know, has laid out. So I'm more, I would say, you know, kind of specific questions for specific candidates, where, you know, other members in the group are, you know, take a broader perspective, where they're not, you know, more writing kind of mission statements in that part, as opposed to really, you know, picking out, you know, trying to find candidates.
More constitutional conservatives as opposed to politicians who may go with the wind or put their finger in the air, as we say. Is that the gist of that? Okay.
So, it is, yes.
Yeah. So last month, 2 months ago, we just added 4 constitutional amendments to our state constitution. That's a pretty big deal when you change the constitution of a state that's been around for 200 years. I was weary of those, but all 4 passed overwhelmingly. Were you in favor of those as a group?
No, we weren't in favor of any of them. We felt like the same way that our laws are written, where you kind of feel like they're written one way, but when you dig into it, it's very different. We felt like the amendments were very much that way, and that, you know, they definitely left the state open to, you know, all kinds of abuses that we think could take place under some of those amendments.
And so now that they're the letter of the law, probably for the next 250 years, what should we be on the lookout? What are some of the most egregious things you saw in there that the fine print is really going to come back with unintended consequences and maybe bite us?
I think one of the worst things that we saw, the one that was really, everyone said, well, that's like an anti-slavery bill. We felt like it really left the door open for, you know, prisons to be able to, you know, use inmates as kind of slave labor.
Exactly.
We felt like that, yeah, was very much the opposite. And I do think that, you know, with Core Civic so, active, and, you know, we have a new person in charge of corrections now that I know has ties to GEO Group, which is also private prisons. So there's definitely some concern there. I mean, we do, every so often we do get people who, you know, will come to us that, you know, have a relative or somebody in prison, and, you know, they feel like there are abuses there. I mean, we just don't have the resources. We're not investigators in that sense. We're investigators looking at the law, but not, you know, investigating situations like that.
But I think your intuition is exactly the same as mine was, because I just saw the future of some enterprising lawyer. Hopefully I don't give anyone any ideas to say, hey, he doesn't want to work. She doesn't want to work. Therefore she's being forced to work for wages. Therefore she's not wages. Therefore she's a slave. Therefore she should be let out of jail or something to that effect. But, you know, turnout was pretty low. Is apathy a problem, or was it too confusing with all the new voting places people weren't used to going to traditionally for a century? Voter turnout also remains an issue in Tennessee. And in the August election last year, only 2 counties recorded more than 50% voter turnout out of the 99. One county had a measly 3.62% voter turnout in that election. How do we improve that? Is it candidate quality?
I think it's multiple things. I think one thing, you know, we look at the percentage of registered voters, but with things like motor voter, we have so many people who register because they're just automatically registered and they don't have to put any effort. But in the end, I mean, those people just don't vote. I mean, we make it easy to register, but, you know, people that want to vote and plan to vote will find a way to register. So I think that's, you know, one of our biggest problems. But we definitely, you know, do have a candidate problem. And like I said, you know, the way we have so many races where people are unopposed, and I think we're starting to see some interest in, you know, this was the first time where we had, I think, almost every, you know, school board and county commission where, you know, somebody had an opponent. But a lot of those local races, you know, people just, they're voting for, you know, an unopposed person. So there's not a lot of incentive. So I think that's part of it. And, you know, also just a lot of understanding what these different offices are. I mean, everybody knows, you know, what the president does, or, you know, who the president is, but, you know, to educate people on who their state rep is, who their senator, state senator is. You know, that those state level positions are so important, and then you know, to get it down to the local, people are definitely confused. I mean, I door knocked probably a little over 4,000 doors this year,
Good for you.
and and you know, so many people, you know, they're just not sure. Well, you know, what is the what's the difference between, you know, the councilmen and the county commissioners and the, you know, city mayor and the county mayor? There's
I find that
so there's
especially
a lot
with
to learn.
Judges. Most people have
Yes.
no transparency on the judges. They just say, oh, that last name or that incumbent or whatever, or, you know, there's no transparency where they get their money, what they're doing for their seat, what their record is. In Washington State, especially, it's a black box to just look into it, or black hole, I should say. What else, who else groups or legislators do you have supporting your efforts in the state that we should give thanks to?
Now, I would say, I mean, our biggest supporter is definitely Janice Bowling. I mean,
Oh,
she
yeah.
is
Senator Janice Bowling.
she is really a warrior for freedom. And, you know, so she would definitely be our number one. You know, Terry Lynn Weaver, who unfortunately got, you know, redistricted and then voted out. You know, she was also a big supporter. Todd Warner has been a big supporter. Bruce Griffey was a big supporter, but now, you know, he went to run for judge. So, so there's been, we're we interested to see how a lot of these new people, you know, it seems like we have some strong new constitutionalists coming in, and there's so much coming at them that we're hoping that, you know, elections will, you know, still be a priority, because if we don't get that wrapped up, then all of these other things can, it'll be easily undone.
Yeah, it seems like the further away from Nashville their county is, the more likely they are to support these type of things. So on that
Yes.
note, then, what groups are getting in your way in Tennessee that are interfering with the education of the public about machines and election fraud?
Boy, I have to say that really, it seems like it's, you know, I would say the definitely the lobbyists and, you know, the local election commissions and administrators, not really so much groups. You know, I think most groups were still like, even the ACLU had a call a few weeks ago that we were on. And I mean, we don't certainly don't agree with what they want to see happen as far as, you know, they'd love to get rid of voter ID and all of that. But I mean, we had a way more extensive dialogue than we do when we speak with some of these legislators and our, you know, county offices. So I guess I feel like it's definitely more the just that entrenched system of all of these, you know, appointed people and the lack of transparency more than any groups.
That's good. It sounds
everything
like the
is,
grassroots is behind you, and then there should be a
yeah.
smooth path to the ears of these people who make the decisions.
Yeah.
But you did try to go to a meeting in Davidson County, didn't you, to get rid of machines, and you weren't allowed in, right? Like $50 a person, some kind of poll tax. And I don't understand why it wasn't free. Pretty shady.
Well, no, they
did that happen?
There's two different meetings. So there is like a paid event that's going on, but the Davidson County meeting, originally they had said it was only going to be residents, and that, you know, anybody who was, you know, working on election integrity across the state, you know, you could only go if you were a Davidson County resident. But they did then, you know, back off of that. So they did allow people in, and we did, you know, have some people that were able to get in and, you know, be part of that. Pretty much it was, and this is kind of what we see a lot of times with the machines is, you know, they took ballots, people were allowed to scan them, and they said, oh, look, everything's scanned correctly, so everything's perfect. And that's, you know, just not the case. And even Tennessee, their own, you know, reports on, you know, from their advisory committee that show the problems with the voting machine, they show many of the problems that we're talking about. I mean, they mention that there are calibration problems. There are just machines that randomly shut down or malfunction. So it's not even just us saying this. You know, Tennessee's own report shows that. And, you know, we've also gone through all of the state election commission minutes. And, you know, the same thing, there's a lot of problems, and a lot of them are documented, but everyone always seems to fall back on, well, we don't think that they would have, materially impacted this election. And, like I said, we have these county elections that are tied or are won by one or two votes. So we don't feel like to say, it was only this many votes that's enough of a reason. We need to be 100% sure. And because really speed isn't the issue. I mean, some things you need to be 100% accurate, and some things speed is more important. And if you hit, 90% accuracy, you're good. But elections are not in that category.
That's correct. So you had, not you, but Tennessee Liberty Network wrote a white paper. It was published by Tennessee Liberty Network, reported that when the American Rescue Plan Act, so now we're changing gears a little bit from elections to schools, was signed by President Joe Biden last March, another $122 billion in ESSER3 funds were allocated to K through 12. This money came with strings attached, unlike the first and second rounds of ESSER funding that was mostly for COVID and trying to get kids back to school, we thought. All school districts in Tennessee that took ESSER3 funds must incorporate social emotional learning programs into their curriculum. What kind of strings, and why did we accept those conditions? Seems like a small percentage of the school's budget, but $122 billion is a lot. What does your group, Tennessee Liberty Network, think about that?
I mean, we feel like it's definitely a takeover of the schools to bring in all of this, all of these counselors and psychologists, and we just feel like it's a way to kind of turn around to make the parents less important and make the schools more important. I mean, it gives a lot of power when all of a sudden you have all of these extra counselors and everyone's talking about teaching empathy, and all these strange things are incorporated into what should really just be straightforward lessons. And like everything else with COVID, these ESSER funds, I mean, they speak about these things as if it's a fact. Like if we present all these, strange, uncomfortable situations to kids in the classroom, that they'll become more empathetic or something like that. And there's just nothing to support that. So, but that's really the only thing that we see, is that it seems like a way to tell the parents, if you have an issue with it, we're the experts, so sit down and shut up and, let us be experts, and you can do your little role as parents.
I mean, Williamson County spent $720,000. That goes a long way towards textbooks and science experiments, but on mental health services, which was nearly 9% of their total ESSER funds allocated to their LEA, whatever that is, school district. The school's district's plan was to contract with an outside vendor to provide 4 clinical social workers for students. That's a lot per 4 doctors. Williamson County Schools stated on its website that their first priority in preparing students for the future is, quote, to expand support services, including social, emotional, physical, and mental health needs. Do we see results of that money in our kids' mental health improving? Is it?
I mean, like I said, we feel like some of the things, like we have books where, second graders are exposed to concepts like suicide. And I mean, to me, at that age, I mean, life should just be all rainbows and happiness. Kids shouldn't be aware of every evil in the world. And, every time we have a school board meeting, we do, get people who are, who work in the school system, who will say, oh, this is so important, that kids need this. But we also have people on the other end, and even mental health professionals that have said, there's nothing that shows that exposing kids to something that's traumatic are going to make them, more empathetic towards maybe a child in the classroom who has actually gone through, some type of horrible, abuse or situation like that. So,
no, maybe
there's
probably more traumatizing
disconnect
than it would be empathetic.
Yes.
Yeah. So ESL really is just critical race theory and diversity, equity, inclusion, but being caught in the classroom all the way down to K through 12. I could see the case for maybe 9, 10, 11, 12, but K through for sure 3, which they want to hold back the kids from third grade because of COVID. That's not good.
Right.
Maury County
No.
Public Schools began mental health assessments on children as young as 8 years old without first getting permission from parents. Tennessee Code 492124 ensures that parents may refuse consent for mental health screenings, evaluation, testing, or examination. TCA 492211 states that every LEA must have a policy that allows parents to review all survey prior to being administered to students. They have earmarked $343,800 for this mental health proposal that includes counselors and curriculum support. So the question is, we got about 5 minutes left. Is that $340,000 at risk of lawsuits for breaking 49-2-124? Because they seem to be doing it without the consent anyway.
Right. I mean, that, we definitely have lots of things that are being challenged by parents. And, we just don't know, if the schools pull back on some of these things, will they lose their funding? Or, what we're telling parents for the most part is, don't rely on your schools to tell you everything or to send papers home and get permission. Anything that you hear around town or see at a school board meeting or just know you don't want your kids exposed to, be proactive and write letters and let your school know that you expect to be notified if these things are going to happen in the classroom or if there's going to be some type of counseling or some type of physical clinic in the school that's doing healthcare. Anything you can think of that you don't want your kids exposed to, and you want to make sure that you have to give permission, be proactive. And we do have different resources to help parents write letters, to their school so that they can do
All right, well said. So, last question. Here's a fun one. The
that.
Department of Homeland Security funded Election Infrastructure Information Sharing and Analysis Center, EI-ISAC garbage, encourages local election officials like you to report misinformation or disinformation to EI-ISAC. The info goes to CISA, which will, quote, submit to the relevant social media platforms for review. CISA was telling Twitter who to censor, basically. What do you make of federal
Right.
election censorship in Tennessee?
Oh my, oh, I mean, we saw so much of it. That's why we use Telegram. And but it's such a big problem. And we were putting through so many open records requests that we were all a little worried when we saw this. I'm thinking, oh, I think I put through like 50 some requests for open records across the state. So I don't know. I'm sure I'm on a list somewhere, as probably all of us are, but we don't let it stop us. We just have to keep going. And Twitter is getting better. I can see that I post things and I don't get a message that I'm banned. Maybe it's shadow banned, but at least I'm not getting an outward that I've been naughty and I'm in the sandbox. So
Yes, less insulting, even if they're still doing it. Well, Mrs. Tobin, thank you for your time. We really appreciate all the efforts you're putting out for us and for coming on here. We are at the end, so please tell our listeners where they can go to find out more about you and your organization and anything else you'd like them to know, please.
Boy, I right now, because we still are a little shadow banned here and there, the best way to find us is still on Telegram. And if you search for Tennessee Liberty Network, we do have a public group that is on there. And we can get them connected to any resources there. And we do also work a lot with Mike Lindell's Cause of America. So anyone that is interested in elections, that's also another great resource as well.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks again for coming on with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
I don't
Welcome to the Steve and Steve segment of our show, where we cover what we just heard. Producer Steve, what did you think of our guest Tina Tobin and Tennessee Liberty Network?
Again, Steve, thanks for bringing on some people who really know what's going on. And this individual, Tina and her crew, are activists. And I love finding out about activists. And it makes... Steve, there's a lot of people doing some wonderful things to fight back against the evil of our day. And I'm glad you're highlighting them. You're giving them a voice. And it's much needed. So kudos to Tina and her crew. And may she be multiplied a thousandfold.
Yeah. Well, look forward to having her back on. And we've had several people who are talking about election integrity. And the good news is they're on it. They've shined the light on it, and it's not in the shadows. They can't hide from us anymore. If they're going to steal elections, it's going to be really overt, no more covert, because too many smart minds like Tina's are on the case, and Tennessee Liberty Network is doing that everywhere, not just Tennessee.
Well, Steve,
represents Tennessee.
It's like I wrote down here some notes about the what was it like before they had machines? Each precinct took care of their own voting. They had people from both sides, apolitical, whatever, and they sat down and they voted each. Everybody counted. They counted twice, and then they went in. They took the lockbox in to wherever they needed to, and that worked, and it still could work today, and I would get rid of every machine. I'd go back to hiring people to actually – I'd actually hire people to vote, you know, to do the vote count if that's what it was or whatever. But I think
but
it could be done.
You know, that's conservative thinking. That's not progress. That's not technology at the speed of science. That would be counting, you know, some counties have 30,000 people in them, you know, you could do that in 1 or 2 hours. How do you nationalize an election if you can't co-mingle all those votes into one data point? So, but that was November. We don't have to worry about this again for several months. And you know what? I miss the holidays. I know they were only 4 weeks ago, but I like the holiday season. What do you like about Christmas, Steve?
Well, my wife, right after Thanksgiving, we set up and start putting up all the pre-Christmas stuff. And what I like about it is just, sure, Christ is in the center of that, but we know that he wasn't born that day. But the bottom line is, it's a merry time of the year. People tend to be generally a lot more warmer, a more... friendly, and it's just no matter where you're at, everybody's got a sense of wonderment and warmth, and
me
we
too.
Can use that.
Me too. And I like the baked goods. I like peppermint bark. I like Alaskan Brewing Company winter ale.
Oh,
like
my winter ales. Yes. All the winter beers. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and I also like gingerbread men. Good time of year for eating. Definitely. Steve, have you ever heard of a gingerbread man?
A gingerbread.
I mean person, gingerbread person.
No.
So Charlotte Hazard, a journalist for Just the News, put together a nice article, 10 examples of woke dogma permeating U.S. government. So I just thought I'd run down these in our segment here today because it's fun. From the halls of Congress to the alphabet soup of federal agencies, woke ideology from gender identity sensitivity training to critical race theory has worked its way into virtually every part of the U.S. government. Here are 10 examples showing how woke dogma has come to permeate the government. Number one, the Department of Veteran Affairs uses a gingerbread person illustration to instruct personnel on gender fluidity among other gender options, including pansexual, two-spirit, agender, and neutroice, according to reporting from the Wall Street Journal. The purpose of this appears to be to re-educate soldiers to believe that gender is not binary, but rather a spectrum. Let's listen to clip number one.
Gender conversation. You use a device or a character called the gingerbread man.
Person.
Sorry. The gingerbread person.
It's okay. I found it really helpful to think about gender in a few different distinct categories. Gender identity, how you define your gender and how you see yourself. Gender expression, the different ways that we present or perform gender through our actions, our dress, and our demeanor, and biological sex or anatomical sex, the physical characteristics that make up our body that in many people's minds equal gender, but don't.
So gender expression is the way you present yourself to the world. So you could be talking about the way you dress.
Yeah.
The way you comb your hair.
Or don't.
Or use product.
Yeah.
So everything kind of as it relates to the outside world,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a perfect way of thinking about it. So even just, okay, so.
Sure.
Yeah.
You do know that there's no longer a Mr. Potato Head.
Right, right. Well, I don't know in the movie who he's married to, but whatever. We have gingerbread persons in the Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm surprised he didn't light Katie Couric on fire when she misgendered that that piece of dough. Number two, biological male soldiers who identify as female are allowed to share bathrooms with biological females in the Army, according to page 29 of the Army's transgender policy, if a biological female is concerned about privacy in terms of showering with an anatomically male transgender woman, they can speak with their commanding officer. In the end, though, they are essentially told to toughen up. Check this one out. Let's play number two.
When I came out to my team, I had some confidence. I could show people that I am fit to serve. I can be successful. Not only can I be successful, I can be better than I was before when I was pretending to be something I wasn't.
It's been over a year since we first met Staff Sergeant Jessica Hout, when she became one of the first soldiers to test out the U.S. military's new policy that trans troops can serve openly.
How did it go?
Went actually great. Sort of like, hey, you know, I've been kind of figuring stuff out for myself over the past few months, and went right to it and was like, hey, I'm transgender and I am going to transition.
The military's previous policy towards trans people was pretty much, if you come out, you can get kicked out. It was also quite literally built around things tweeted by former President Trump.
Company.
The Department of Defense is estimated to be one of the country's biggest employers of trans people, so allowing trans soldiers to serve openly was a dramatic step forward.
Wow. Wow, Steve.
Number three, NASA has launched an Allyship for Executives, A-L-L-Y-S-H-I-P, Allyship for Executives, which counsels that the term African-American is utilized heavily in white spaces and can make Black people feel excluded. The agency that first landed a man on the moon also has a tip sheet on microaggressions, which cautions that it's inappropriate to ask an Asian person to help with a math or science problem. Number four, the Department of Homeland Security has used a cartoon in diversity training sessions to promote inclusive diversity. The cartoon is titled The Real Pain of Exclusion and claims that micro inequities can be combated by micro affirmations because social and physical pain produce similar brain responses. Let's hear clip number three.
Have blind spots, and these blind spots cause us to exclude people who are different from us. The research in UCLA a couple of years ago demonstrated that the part of the brain that lights up when you cut your finger is the same part of the brain that lights up when you feel excluded. So there's actually a physical and physiological reaction to not being included in the meeting, included in the party, included in the dinner event, etc. So we all have a reaction to it. But the idea of inclusion is a very soft word. It's not a word that makes people react in a tense way. Everyone wants to be included. I have never met anyone who says, Helen, I'm going to work today in order to feel excluded. So I think that all of us intuitively and inherently want to feel included.
You have to see the picture.
So yeah, not a healthy specimen. I hope she's not in the healthcare industry. Social and physical pain produce similar brain responses. That's what that's all about. Number five, names such as the Washington Redskins and Robert E. Lee High School are microaggressions, according to page three of the NASA tip sheet on microaggressions. It defines their impact slash message as, quote, you don't belong here, or quote, you're not welcome here. Number six, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, spent $313,000 on diversity training that included courses like, quote, eight tactics for courageous workplace conversations about race, or let's talk about systemic racism, unconscious bias, and privilege, and silence is a statement, understanding race in the workplace. Let's hear clip number four.
Our brain is hardwired to trust what's familiar and be suspicious of what's unfamiliar. It's a basic survival instinct that's helped keep us safe for thousands of years.
We unconsciously sort things into familiar versus unfamiliar, same versus different, them versus us. Here's a test. How do you feel about people who own a handgun?
Don't attend church.
Vote for the other candidate.
Are on welfare.
Don't eat meat.
Have tattoos.
Don't believe in marriage.
Drive an electric car.
Didn't go to college.
Don't speak English.
Curse.
Are over 60.
Are disabled.
Drive the speed limit.
Love cats.
Love dogs. Can you feel your brain sorting people into groups? Was there a little them versus us happening? It can happen unconsciously.
Unconscious bias and privilege. I mean, that's the CDC, right? Center for Disease Control. You would think that they would care about all human beings that are susceptible to disease, not just groups, but okay. Number seven, the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, offers a two-hour seminar on unconscious bias titled Checking Your Blind Spots, Ways to Find and Fix Unconscious Bias. The seminar urges confronting unconscious bias because it can lead people, teams, and organizations to be less creative, inclusive, and effective. Number eight, pregnancy transition is the term used in the Army when a biological female who identifies as a male stops taking male hormones in order to start a family. Commanding officers are trained how to react when a soldier approaches them to discuss his newly confirmed pregnancy. Number nine.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry. Number nine. Privilege Bingo is a game that can be played at the VA during its Managing Gender Diversity training. In Privilege Bingo, squares that can be marked off include no criminal record, military experience, and married. Let's play the last clip.
Privilege Bingo in Fairfax Company class meets controversy for including being a military kid. A controversial assignment in a Fairfax County, Virginia, public school class asked students to play Privilege Bingo, but one of the criteria for privilege was being from a military family, something that some people found upsetting. The assignment,
Jesus,
which was in a high school English class,
yeah, it's hard to hear. Let's quit that one.
I don't know. Jump. They've got like three, four. They're blending all these different things together. Sorry, Steve. It's just weird video.
Yeah, that's totally okay.
I think the point is made. Weird. Yes, it is.
Yeah. Number 10, NASA hosts a seminar led by former Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's Chief Diversity Officer Janice Underwood that declares reverse racism does not exist while acknowledging that individuals of color can be prejudiced and biased. The training rejects the colorblind ideal central to the teaching of Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement that ended de jure segregation in the U.S., counseling participants avoid language like, I don't see color, I'm colorblind, I treat everyone the same, I just hire the best person. Underwood now leads the Diversity Bureau at the Federal Office of Personnel Management. And let's just finish this off with this gem of taxpayer-funded Make the World Better programs of Ms. Underwood. Clip number six, please.
I'm Dr. Vanessa Weaver, your host of Working It Out. I'm speaking today with Dr. Janice Underwood. She's the Chief Diversity Officer for the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is the state of Virginia. Mm-hmm. We're going to discuss her role and responsibility as the country's first cabinet level Chief Diversity Officer, and that's a big deal. And we're going to also speak to her about this whole role of critical race theory and its impact on the recent gubernatorial election. And then we're gonna also end our show with Dr. Underwood sharing with us what she sees as the state of diversity, particularly as she transitions out of her role as the Chief Diversity Officer in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I wanna say, first of all, welcome, Dr. Underwood.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Weaver. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much for making the time. I know you're planning transitions with the new administration that's coming in, and also thinking about your own next moves in your life and in your career. So it's no small matter that you made this time for us today. So thank you so very, very much for it. And you are a phenomenal person, Dr. Underwood, and in many ways have significantly impacted the state of the status of diversity in Virginia. For example, you've had 25 years in public service, and I don't see 25 years in public service anywhere on your face, but maybe you said you got the memories.
I appreciate
of all of that. Yeah. And as the chief diversity officer in the state of Virginia, you built this One Virginia, which was a statewide strategic plan for inclusion across more than 100 state agencies and other public and private sectors. So I know I got some more background to read about you, but what, tell us a little bit about this One Virginia. I was intrigued by that.
Well, thank you for the question. The bottom line is diversity, equity, and inclusion has never really existed at the intersection of government and politics. And the One Virginia plan is the first ever statewide strategic plan for DE&I. But what's so amazing about it, it was a collaborative effort. It was an opportunity for all sectors in the Virginia economy, state government, local government, higher ed, and so many other corporate partners come together and say what they want in a statewide plan. Then we went around the state and shared our findings in developing the plan with a volunteer steering committee. And then we launched the plan. It is a plan for more than 100 state agencies. And what's so amazing about it is that it's nonpartisan. It's about building diversity-led innovation. It's about really trying to say, let's set a benchmark for where we are. You can't change what you don't measure, and you can't measure that what you don't acknowledge. And as of right now, we have 82 plans submitted, and we have a few more plans on the way with a few extensions. And we're working with agencies iteratively to say, even though you've submitted your plan and we've reviewed your plan, we're providing support, unprecedented support to say, how can we even make these plans better?
Oh, Steve.
You know how you can make them better? She's out of a job. Anything else you want to comment on this wonderful list of 10 things our taxpayers?
When she was using that whole litany of all these different departments, it reminds me of yesterday's Dr. David Black. Stakeholder, government, stakeholder, community, stakeholders, all these entities are working together, quite frankly, to undermine what we know as our God-blessed country, United States of America.
And the Constitution. Exactly. Stay tuned for my thought of the week. Welcome to my thought of the week. But before I share, I want to remind everyone to subscribe to Mill Creek View podcast. Just go to Rumble or iHeart and hit the subscribe button and follow us. And thanks for doing it. This process of election affords a moral certainty that the office of president will seldom fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. Alexander Hamilton, American politician and founding father of the U.S. Well, that didn't necessarily work out so good. We do not have government by the majority. We have government by the majority who participate. Thomas Jefferson. The ballot is stronger than the bullet. Abraham Lincoln. Not for him, but for America, certainly. He also said nearly all men can stand adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him power. Voting is the only way to ensure that your concerns matter, period. Michelle Obama, former First Lady. That's it for this episode. Really hoped you liked it. Thank you, Tina Tobin, for keeping Tennessee, Tennessee for us. Until next time, this is your host, Steve Abramowitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Mill Creek View newspaper. Peace in our time. We'll be right back.
Any views or opinions represented on the podcast are personal and belong solely to the creator and do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the creator may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated.